Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or simply hoping to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall.
All right, here we are at the International Conference for Psychology, Counseling, and Education, all the way in the Philippines.
Recording live from the Philippines.
This is the farthest I've ever been from home.
And you can't walk home.
I can't walk.
The other day. I've never been any place where I can't walk home.
Well, that's what I'm so excited about. No matter where I am, I've always been able to just walk home if I had to. And that's just not going to work here. But this is our first recording here at the conference, and we are with a longtime friend, Frazier Smith. It's so good to see you again.
You too.
Actually, meet you in person.
I know, it's been via laptop in my back bedroom last night, which is weird, but that's where I was, yeah. So it's cool to meet you guys in flesh. Yeah. I know you're real now. You're not just making up my imagination.
we're just computer generated.
Yeah.
It was great. But it has been fantastic here, and you did a talk yesterday here at the conference.
Yeah.
On a topic very similar to what we talked about in our previous interview with you, which was fantastic.
Yeah, that's right.
And you presented some really amazing statistics, and so hopefully we'll talk a little bit about some of that, but certainly just talk a little bit about the conference in general, perhaps, and kind of get into that.
For sure, this is great,
And also, give us a reminder of the research that you did.
Yeah, so my research base is on men's mental health, and I think last time we spoke a lot about the developing issue, the growing issue of men's mental health both in the United Kingdom, and you kind of gave me some insight which was really valuable about the state of that in the States as well, which was great. And you know, and that research has kind of grown a little bit into focusing a little more into older men since we last spoke, and just kind of going in more depth into that research. So yeah, it's been a growing process since we last spoke.
Fantastic. You know, after we did our last interview, we ended up a couple of months later, I think, we did a little bit more on men's mental health and, you know, some of the research that we were finding, and I don't mean to spring this on you, because I know you were just saying that you are looking at older, the older population, but we were looking at what some of the research is saying as far as boys, and how, you know, over the past decade or two, we've really been working to build up opportunities and create opportunities for women, which is hugely important.
Yeah.
But by doing so, it's sort of left boys in a state where they are having to, sort of the assumption is that they're going to be fine. Yeah. They're the boys, so they're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
And it's leaving a lot of boys in dire straits.
I think that's the case. I think it's got a lot to do with our understanding of what mental health conditions are applicable to boys, young men, you know, however you want to term that. And you know, recently there was some research that came to the forefront of the media in Britain about one in four girls have an eating disorder under the age of 10, I think. So, you know, when media outlets like that portray a lot about these mental health disorders associated to young girls, which as you said is valuable and applicable, it does leave us thinking less about young boys' mental health. And you know, I still think, you know, the presentation which I gave yesterday about mental health conditions of men, I think are applicable to boys of any age. You know, we just don't associate mental health issues as well with young boys as we should. You know, we can reserve it for however you want to call it, a feminine thing or something that women struggle with more, when actually the issue is just as prevalent with men. And it's the case from a very, very young age as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think it is. And, you know, we've worked so hard in our country, and whether it's the same in the UK or here in the Philippines, we work so hard to advantage girls because we have seen it as being disadvantaged. Sexism and the glass ceiling, there's things that appear so much about the media. So we work so hard to give girls the advantage that now we're seeing in many fields the scales are tipping, have tipped in the favor of girls, and boys are being left behind. Which shouldn't surprise anybody, because we've never addressed these issues in boys anyway. For a long time, we thought that we didn't need to, because they were already advantaged.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, what you're saying about being already advantaged, one of the things I spoke about yesterday was this concept of zero-sum gender beliefs,
yes,
which is a growing aspect of research, and is, I found yesterday it can be quite challenging to talk about, because you don't want to be misconstrued when one group wins, the other loses, and when we're looking at equality and developing rights for women, which is absolutely appropriate, we can't ignore that in turn, sometimes men can lose out, young boys can lose out. And there's also a concept there, I feel, that is to say a little bit more about how, you know, boys, and I'm suffering from mental health issues, I can't hear someone ever telling me that I'm a boy and shouldn't cry,
you man up.
Yeah.
You know, this whole concept of, you know, be a man, be strong,
yeah,
and, you know, don't show your emotions, don't cry, don't, and we do, we instruct our boys in that perspective from the start.
Yeah, we do. We absolutely do. We get that term. I feel like there's a campaign in that term somewhere to re-terminology, you know, to change it into something else, you know, because I just like that term, something I used to hear when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
It has such a weight of expectation. It's not just something that we throw out. It means be a man, whatever that means, you know, be strong. Don't cry, don't express weakness, don't go and ask for help, you can do this in your own manner. I feel quite passionate about that term, because every time I hear it, it grates on me, and I really would love to, in some way, change that man up term to mean something of, you know, men who aren't scared to express emotion, or aren't scared to ask help, or aren't scared to say that they are struggling with something. I would love for it to mean something more than that. And
I agree, I think we should.
Yeah.
We'll have to work more, and we'll come up with something.
Yeah, that'd be
together
class.
With that.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. It'd be really, really cool.
Yeah.
You know, I was watching all these TV, some of it's on TV, and men are treated differently across cultures and across time. Some of it is religious, some of it is cultural. But you're constantly given this notion that boys have a different status. You know, the rights of men. Whether it's out of your bodies or putting your hands in high hands, or these things, that these ordeals that we put boys through, that we don't do with girls.
No.
So you're also fighting this, should we call it, instinctual.
Yeah, the rite of passage almost.
Yeah.
Like, what rings a bell for me is that back home, and I know with the parents of the kids, like initiation processes and things like that. They have similar things in universities back home in Scotland and in the UK with sports teams, and it's like a rite of passage that you do something painful or something that's
hazing.
Exactly, yeah, completely. So it's, you know, I do think that these kind of things are associated with men, and as you said, there's a cultural aspect to that as well. You know, one of the things I spoke a lot about yesterday on masculinity and that cultural element, speaks to the subjectivity of each individual man and the environment in which they're placed, and we need to appreciate these things better if we're going to understand men. And I really do think that understanding men is at the foundation of what this is. I was speaking to one of the students at our conference yesterday, and she asked me at the end, you know, she was saying, what is the biggest issue? And I explained that I think it's identity, it's who we perceive men to be. And that comes under so many different brackets, you know, the historical element, the cultural element. And we don't understand men, we don't think we understand masculinity. And I think that's key.
When I thought that was brilliant, what you were talking about yesterday, is the areas that you were talking about that represents what we refer to as masculine, or as being a man.
Yeah.
And it was just great to look at, you know, those areas. As far as what masculine is, what these various aspects that contribute to what we think of as men.
Yeah, really, I think it's important to understand those elements.
So talk a little bit about those areas that you're referring to as what defines a man.
Yeah, so, you know, I think with concepts of identity, you know, we need to look at how and what identifies a man as being socially constructed. And that has a lot to do with us. So when we're talking about, like, what defines a man, or how we get over that barrier, that hurdle, it really starts with everybody else. I don't really think that's a task to be undertaken necessarily by the individual man, although of course there's roles to play there. But the social constructionism of you know, our perceptions of what a man should do, the roles a man should play, the jobs a man should have. I really think that those elements are important when we're thinking about the identity and different concepts. You know, I spoke a little bit about how this is a historical aspect as well. You know, some of the research has shown that masculinity and hegemonic masculine principles are passed down from father to son. And as a result, you know, which may come as no surprise, but it in turn makes it very difficult to break this cycle. You know, it's we're told about how to be a man from fathers, but at the same time, you know, there's other, like you were talking about media and things like that, and TV and movies, because, you know, boys don't have fathers necessarily around, they still kind of adopt these masculine principles. So we need to understand that. I think we also need to understand the cultural thing. I don't know what it's like in the States, but in Scotland, I think I might have talked about this actually when we last spoke. There's a thing called the West of Scotland male, which I'm from the West of Scotland, and it basically is everything that you would think of as being a really stereotypical man, and absolutely no emotion is likely shown. Tearful emotions or crying in any way is not acceptable. I actually remember my wedding. During my wedding speech, I managed to cry about 13 times, and you could see the look of disapproval from someone there. So I feel quite good that I managed to break that stereotype a little bit. But you know, there's so many different constructs, so many different factors to my identity that we need to appreciate for an understanding.
Absolutely, the story you told about your grandfather was perfect. I mean, it was, you know, he. Working bricklaying, right?
Yeah, he was bricklaying.
Fell 20 something feet.
He did, yeah.
Shattered his arm.
Yeah.
To go back and
he wanted to get back up. I, you know, that was. I remember getting that call actually when I was a young kid that he had fallen this incredible height and managed to survive it. And immediately I got back up and wanted to get back to work. And I saw him a few weeks ago, you know, or so later, and he was just a mess, like broken, bruised. You know, that had a lot to do with identity, and I used that example with him because, you know, I can imagine with him his identity was a lot to do with work, and that was then taken away from him when he was so badly injured. And, you know, that would have had a real impact on his mental health.
Absolutely. And the part that we didn't mention was that he was in his 70s. Right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was in his 70s, actually. Yeah, in the early 70s. I'm pretty sure that's right, yeah. That would be right, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he's stopped in that age. I don't think he would have stopped even now.
Right.
I think he probably would still be doing it. Yeah, he's definitely good.
Amazing. So, as you mentioned earlier, that part of your research or your interest now is shifting to the older population.
Yeah.
And you mentioned in the talk yesterday about this really. I'd never thought about it until you mentioned it. The idea that as we get older, our identity shifts from being a male to being old.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible shift.
Yeah, it's huge. You know, and it's termed as a kind of degenderization, where, you know, men are no longer classed as being men and women. They're combined as an identity of elderly people, which, you know, it comes back to this principle of how important identity is. So, you know, this concept, I talked a little bit about as well, about the feminization that men experience, or the qualitative research anyway, the express that they experience, because, you know, that their working role is taken away, their physical abilities as much are taken away, there's physical limitations, all these kind of things that are associated with being a man are taken away very, very quickly. So it can start to feel like the identity is shifting and the identity is lost. And I spoke about, you know, how masculinity through a lifespan can change. But there's always, as like from birth to adolescence to employment to fatherhood, you know, the masculine identity changes, but it's often replaced with different masculinities. Whereas when we get old, it's not. It's replaced with something completely else, different, you know, something foreign.
I had never thought about that before. It was shocking to see that slide.
Yeah.
Where you're spoken of, identified, and labeled differently.
Yeah.
After a certain age.
Yeah, completely. And
is that true for men and women?
I think, you know, the research in itself, and I suppose I've got to be careful that my bias is in research that I focus primarily on men's research. However, that same research does say that it is probably more the case for men, the sense of identity shift. There's also kinds of stereotypes and perhaps we could get into that would maybe illustrate that a little bit better. But for men, you know, the research shows that men time and time again experience, and I think we can see from the experiences of when they experience improvements as older men. So social integration in care homes, or studies recently conducted in 2016-17 that show that men really do gain huge benefits from that social integration and the development of social groups, more so than women. And they argue that's coming back to the fact that men experience this identity shift to a greater degree. You know, when they do the pre-tests in these studies, it's shown that there's higher depressive rates in older men. And I said yesterday as well, we're talking a lot about the suicide rates and things, which I think are really important in illustrating the issue. And older men are the most at risk of any age, of any demographic, of any group. It's older men that are most at risk. And I actually read some stuff about the statistics in the United States of older men of 60 plus. I can't remember off the top of my head that they were striking. It's incredible, the rate of suicides in older men in that demographic.
Men don't have any preparation for older men for that phenomenon to happen. Women do.
Mm.
Women have this period
of
midlife where there is sort of preparation
in
this phase. Men don't have that.
Yeah, I think it can be quite striking. I think it can be a very sudden shift, like you say. It can be a very sudden shift. And so, how are men prepared for that, when so much of their identity is to do with that kind of middle life period.
At the same time, testosterone levels are falling.
Yeah.
And so you have sort of a perfect storm.
Oh, yeah, you do.
This will occur.
You do. And I think the biological factor to older men is something I went into. It's needing more research, and I do think that area is, because the studies are so different, but it's so hard to directly attribute these things. But I definitely do think that the reduction in testosterone, hormonal imbalances as men become older, really do have a role to play for sure.
Do you have any idea why this isn't studied in that? I mean,
the
testosterone levels decline with age. People even say that in TV commercials. They're getting former athletes to say, "Well, I stay in shape by taking these supplements." So we know that testosterone levels decrease, and when they do, depression is often the result.
And that's absolutely the case. The reason to maybe answer your question why it's so
it's almost taboo.
Yeah, it is. I think it's because the research that looks into the biological factor and the reduction of testosterone, it can be easily critiqued in the sense that there can be so many other different factors that contribute to the reduction of depression in older men. And some even go as far as saying, really is the increase in depressive symptoms in older men as a result of testosterone reduction, or is it just an inevitable part of growing old? And I think those two things, yes, okay, it's a criticism, the biological factor, but they're really hard to differentiate. And how do you know if it's a reduction in testosterone, or what's the difference between that and actually growing old?
Well, and the other thing from the biological research is that as your status in the group rises, testosterone levels increase.
Yeah.
As your status declines, testosterone decreases.
Well, and as we just said, it will.
Here we go.
Yeah.
As their status is declining, testosterone levels are decreasing.
And I think as well, I think there is something to be said about being at a high to being at a low. And what I mean by that is that I said yesterday when I was talking about the use of the interviews, as a white middle class male, I'm under no illusion of how privileged I am in society, and how lacking discrimination I never experienced in my life, nor in my will I. To go from that to then you're old, you've got to put you in a nursing home, or whatever it is that is attributed to the individual male and growing old. It's from a huge high to a real low, and that needs to be appreciated in how much that change can have a real impact.
So, my father-in-law was a professional athlete, baseball player, coach for 62 years.
Yeah.
And he aged gracefully, because I think of what Erickson said, he looked back at his life and said, this has been a pretty good life.
Yeah.
But when he began to get sick, it deteriorated very rapidly. And you can see this, your work, I could see in him,
right,
when he reached that point.
And you and I spoke a lot about situations like that earlier as well, and how that, maybe contracting an illness or having something sick increases reliance on others. One of these things I spoke about yesterday is this concept of personal mastery, where the reduction of personal mastery, which is an ability to undertake tasks autonomously and effectively, is just nowhere in it. It's not an option for some of them. And as a result, massive increases in social support are needed, which in turn makes personal mastery even worse. So, and so much of this is just attributed to the identity of men. And like you said, it's such a sudden shock that they just don't know.
Absolutely. And I think that the moving research into this direction, I think, is going to be massive. Because I think one of the things you mentioned also is the aging population is growing. And this is one of the fastest growing, just demographics, pure numbers, because of the baby boomers approaching that age. So we need to have more and more research looking at what's going to happen with these individuals.
Yeah, we do. And I think the mental health of these individuals is directly correlated to their physical health and well-being. And not to make this about an economical issue, but there's massive, for the UK, anyway, there's massive restraints on economically states as well, on an aging population and what is required there. And I think because of that, because of the illnesses and the challenges with old health that occur, we can sideline mental health once again, which we do so often. We can sideline mental health and say, no, we actually have to focus on the physical illness, which of course is appropriate. But I really do think that mental illness and physical illness are related. If we work with that mental health,
I mentioned the ACEs study.
Yes.
And they are physical health and mental health, both deteriorate. It's not one or the other, they deteriorate together.
We know so little about these correlations. You mentioned a lot about the literacy levels and mortality, and how that's correlated, and the research shows that. And we just don't appreciate things like that. We don't see that if we improve literacy rates or we invest in education systems and improve literacy rates, we're going to see improvements as well. We just don't get that.
Yeah.
And it's the same mental health.
One other question. While we were here in the Philippines, one of the recurring themes that I heard people talk to you about was, we take care of our elderly.
Yeah.
We don't shuffle them off the restroom.
Yeah.
Is there any research, is there any cross-cultural research, the variables that you're studying in Scotland or the UK or the US, compared to cultures that take care of the elderly? Is it different?
I think that's a good question. Not to my knowledge. I think I would be interested in understanding more about what's meant by taking care of our elderly. That was said a lot yesterday, actually, in a Filipino context here in Manila, and across the country, that the taking care of the elderly is a cultural thing, something that is expected. And that's not the case in the United Kingdom, not the case in the States. No,
not at all.
The cross-cultural nature of these studies that I think are really important. There's actually a lot of research that looks at the differences. I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that this research is based in North America, but the differences between American men and Mexican men, and therapeutic preferences, and differences in mental health disorders to an extent. Therapeutic preferences primarily, but I do think there's something definitely for the older men research. Something really interesting about having a correlation or understanding the difference or the similarities between a culture that values their elderly and a culture that doesn't value their elderly. You spoke earlier, and I actually spoke earlier about it, and this kind of Far Eastern mentality of the elderly people actually value the society. We don't view that.
We don't
think that they're valued.
And there are cultures where they probably overhear.
Oh, yeah.
With the Native American cultures, for example.
Yeah.
They were revered
because
of their wisdom.
Yeah.
That ethic is gone.
It makes me wonder if it would be interesting to decide. I think yours was a very good point that we need to really figure out what we mean by taking care of our elderly.
Yeah.
Because even taking care of your elderly we still have that identity issue that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's always been the one that took care of everyone else.
Yeah.
And now he's being taken care of
exactly.
by his kids or
yeah.
his grandkids or whatever. And that could lead to that same type of issue.
Again, it comes back to identity. It comes back to our understanding of masculinity or the social constructionism of masculinity and male identity. And you know, like I said, with personal mastery and excessive social support, and how these two things can really have an impact. You know, I think you make a great point in the fact that, well, it's not just as simple necessarily saying, right, well, okay, well, in the States and in the UK, we need to look after our elder men better. We need to do things for them. Well, yes, that would be nice, but it would also potentially have even other negative consequences in the sense of further loss of identity. And is that a case of where we need to look after our older men better and do things for them, or is it a case where we need to value them more? I would definitely say, you know, it's a value nature that's vital for the older men.
Yeah, there's the sense too that we're going to do better with older men when we do better starting with boys.
Yeah, completely.
You know, when boys become more comfortable talking about these things and being a little bit more vulnerable and some of that, and by the time then they get older,
yeah.
it's going to be very, very different.
One of the key things in men's mental health, and mental health in general, in the United Kingdom, and for me, and I say this so often, and I'm really passionate about it, we are so good at reacting to bad mental health, and we do not in any way develop good mental health. So we say, oh no, there's a problem here with mental health in men, or older men. Let's do something about it. Well, inevitably it won't be the right thing, or it's too late, or whatever. What we don't do is we don't invest in actually developing positive mental health. And that absolutely has to come first. So when you're talking about young boys, you shouldn't just keep pulling young boys aside and saying, we think you might have issues with mental health, you might have some mental health problems, and leaving everybody else, because everybody will experience challenges with their mental health at some point. And if they're not equipped, they're not educated to develop good mental health and take care of their mental health, then we're going to continue to see these issues.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier, and you know, certainly in your talk yesterday, you mentioned some striking statistics. And I know we're running short on time because you have another talk to do.
I do, but that's okay. We're fine for then.
Oh, we are?
Yeah, we're good. We got that thing.
Okay, great. So the graphic was fantastic. It was a dark screen with just these huge numbers.
Yeah.
6 million
Yeah, 58% in the... Yeah. High. 70, yeah. That was part of the presentation in the sense that I really wanted to get those figures across. And I think I was, before the presentation, I was a little bit concerned that, you know, maybe I had gone or potentially would go into too much depth into these stats. But when I think about it, actually, I think it was warranted. You know, we really need to get it across. You know, in the UK, 78% of suicides conducted are by men. In the States, 79%. 6 million men in America each year diagnosed with depression. And you know, that one statistic really sticks out to me. In the UK, it's 84 men a week take their own lives. You know, and for your viewers, you know, there was a campaign ran which I gave the visuals of mannequins placed around the edge of a national television station, 84 in total to represent that. And it's just incredible to think that, you know today's Friday, since last Friday, 84 men have died because of suicide. It's just incomprehensible. You know, and on an international level, 630,000 men a year are dying from suicide, and we're seeing such small therapeutic uptake rates in the United Kingdom. 36% of the population in therapy are men. You know, so this is huge. Majority stats in suicide amongst men. Yet men are consistently a huge minority, a very, very small minority in therapy cutting. It just doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. And when you think about 6 million men are diagnosed with depression, it just makes you wonder how many are not.
Exactly. Well, I think that's something we said as well. And that's just in the States.
Yeah.
And you know, and again, we come back to men coming forward for therapy. And it's not even, men do not have, just not only just an issue with coming forward with therapy. The same research says they come forward, they have issues coming forward for any kind of diagnosis, which means going to the doctors. I mean, even on a physical health level, men are less likely to go and see treatment. If they have the flu or if they even really chronic illnesses, men are much less likely to seek help So, you know, the 6 million a year, I don't think that's just, I don't think we fully understand the extent of the issue by any stretch of the
That's what alarms me. When I was looking at the data yesterday, that's the tip of the iceberg. There's so much underneath that they just either don't report, they self-report. We don't even know that they're out. We know that they're out, but we just don't know how many.
No, how severe. We don't. And I think it's amazing to me because every week in the United Kingdom, we hear new statistics that are bigger than the ones the week before, the week prior. You know, I remember years ago, it was 1 in every 10 young boys who experienced mental health. It's like 10%. And then the next year, it was 1 in every 5, and then it's 1 in every 4. And it's just never ending because it's not a case of mental health getting worse necessarily, although I do think that is a factor. I do think as well, though, we're understanding the statistics are just really scratching the surface, beginning to understand the actual extent of what.
Now, one of the things that we're really getting into a lot in our practice is the issue of stress. Because stress, I think it's going to come out that stress is the root of so many mental health and physical health issues that we experience. And you know, the world is just getting more and more stressful.
Totally. Reminded a lot about one of the presentations yesterday from Professor Jamie Hark Hughes, who talked about trauma and massive man-made and natural disasters. And what one of the things he said was that this experience of being a part of these disasters has the same effects as extreme high stress, you know. And I definitely think the stress has so much to do with that. And I think as well, you know, I know the fantastic presentations you both gave today about the educational system and the expectations weighted on children of any, boys and girls, of achieving grades, of doing well in school, of conforming, is really impactful for stress levels and as a result, mental health.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Well, I think that we're going to let you get to so you get ready for your talk.
Thank you. I can talk with you. Yes.
Yes.
Cool. Really appreciate you having me. And, it's been great to chat in person this time, which is a step up.
It's really special.
Yeah, we're going to have to think of something for next year now as well.
Absolutely. We're already talking about where we're going next.
Yeah.
So we'll meet up again and talk some more. But.
Awesome.
So, well, thanks again, and
thank you.
Wonderful talk, and good luck with your next one.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing this episode of the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you will find all of our previous podcasts and much more. We would be honored if you would become a patron through patreon.com, where any donation you can manage will go to the development and creation of more content. Just visit patreon.com/themental breakdown for more information. Thanks again for listening. Have an awesome day, and we look forward to being back in your feed tomorrow morning.